10 years, 200 years. Depends on how long you think the children of Israel are out in the wilderness. I'd take it on the outside measure, a few hundred years, if you like. Still there developed out there a body of law which was not only unusual and really without precedent in our legal systems, but also one which developed extreme rapidity. Moses had a lot of help. He also played it cool. You know, if Moses, in the 11th chapter of Numbers, having been met by his father-in-law, who saw him sitting, Moses sitting in his tent, you know, with a line of petitioners outside, waiting to come up and try their case about their camel or whatever it was, and the father-in-law being helpful, as all in-laws are, said, and I can't quote it exactly, but it's about like this: Moses, you've got holes in your head. If you think you can settle all of the justiciable items that are going to come out of this group of people out here, boy, you've got trouble. What you need is a judiciary. So Moses says, that's not bad. I better talk that over with headquarters, and he did. And he was instructed to take 70 of the leaders and establish the Supreme Court, and then get some law, some rules. Now, if Moses had put up on the bulletin board one day a notice saying that I'm going to the tent for 30 days and think about this, and when I come out, I will have done my sociological studies and I will announce what the rules are, he probably would have been stoned. Instead of that, he, with more finesse than Barnum and Bailey ever had, went to work. He had mountains that smoked and shook. By the time Moses got back with the rules, there was no question. There was the law. There was the law. And this kind of deep awe and respect for what one might call authority is very significant, because people have to believe that the law is to be used, it's effective, that it has efficacy. Or else we would be at the bottom of the line and the question being asked again, whose army are you going to use? But you mustn't get carried away with the idea that the law is, for that reason, necessarily sacrosanct and beyond any kind of change. This is dangerous. And I think this has got to be avoided. Otherwise, you'll have people like Paul Hayne dashing off with all sorts of absurdities. So we've got to come back and take a look at that again. Law is useful. It's useful for the process of making these changes. But it is useful only because it is part of the method. It's a system and it's the way of doing things. All right. One sees these various uses that we've been talking about of the law. And now one could ask the question fairly at this point, well, but how do you do it? How does it work? What are the schemes? Well, there have been over the years, over the centuries, several different theories about this kind of thing. I'm sure that most of you are already conversant with the major ones. And while I'm sweeping along, taking a few hundred years in each direction with every sentence, let me roll in a couple thousand more years. We all know something, at least the name of so-called natural law. Thomas Aquinas, I suppose, would be the outstanding name that we would attach to this sort of thing. The English common law judges, you know, never admitted that they ever made a rule. The judge, at least the way he talked about it, sat there on the woolsack. They always sat on the woolsack. You can't see the law unless you sit on a woolsack. He would sit there on the woolsack, and he would look up into the skies, and there he would sort of see written the law. Or at least he would in some way perceive it, and he would understand it, and then he would simply announce it. It is the law, that. And you'd never get a good old English common law judge to admit that he was making law. He was simply announcing it. He was applying the rules. It was always the law, not the man. See, this is why Mary Hinderly sandpapers me so effectively with her quote from Solon, because even back in the days of Solon, he knew that ultimately the judges there were making the rules, not just announcing them. Somewhat later, a man by the name of Hans Kelsen, he was a Viennese type, a brilliant scholar, brilliant jurist, started writing in the early 1920s. His best works out of that period. I suppose the thing he's best known for is a book called The Natural Science of Law, or Pure Science, sometimes translated. the straight good, see? Law, says Kelson, is simply positing something that you want done, first of all, that you want to accomplish, and then it's using rigid, almost mathematical deduction to accomplish that purpose. Anything that subserves the Grundnorm, the basic principle, that's good, that's law. I did some of my graduate work under Hans Kelson. He was an old man by that time. He is a Jew. He would frequently stand in the hallway when we were chatting, and I can remember more than one occasion. His eyes would fill with tears, and he would sort of do with me as he did with many students and sort of grab my coat lapels and say, "Ricky, do you think I'm responsible for Hitler's destruction of the Jews?" What do you say? You say, sure. Along with some other people that failed, Kelson, you certainly were a major contributor to what happened in Germany. Because the pure science of law, the notion that anything that subserves the good of the ruling power, that you simply structure your rules to serve that objective, is pure Kelsen. And that's what you did. You gave it to Germany at the time that she needed it most. Now you see, Aquinas is an absolute master at giving us the broad principles for which we could die gladly, the sweeping, overarching generalities, sort of like the golden rule. Do unto others as you'd have them do to you. Last week we had a railroad strike. Suppose that you try and resolve the railroad strike by going to labor and management and saying, "Gentlemen, the law is do unto others as you'd have them do unto you." And then they'd say, "And what does that mean in this case?" And you'd say, "Well, just apply it and don't ask a bunch of silly questions." Somebody endorsed the check somewhat erroneously, and it went through three intermediate banks, and finally it got paid out, and the man on the other end is not responsible. Somebody in between gets hooked. Who gets hooked on the bad check? Rule, do unto others as you'd have them do unto you. It simply doesn't solve problems. Kelson is the guy that solves problems. Trouble is with Kelson is that he doesn't give you any principles. There's nothing up there on the top that protects you from being wiped out if you happen to be of the wrong nationality. So we in the United States developed a kind of a madness which is indigenous to us. You might call it the American proposition if you like. We start out with documents that talk about completely inane and silly things like, we think it's self-evident that people are endowed by their creator with inalienable rights. Now, if you ever heard a bunch of garbage, there it is. What in the world is an inalienable right? The right is something that you have when you can go to a judge and say, "Judge, they trample on my right, and I want you to send the man in blue with a nightstick out to see to it that justice is done. That is, go out and beat somebody on the head, or get some money for me, or rectify this principle. Because if I've got a right, you've got a duty. If you've got a right with respect to me, I've got a duty. And it exists only when you can get it enforced." That's what the law says. Well, in this process, you see, you are trying to resolve these competing demands. And yet you're trying to use a principle up here which has an overriding validity to it. One which, in the last analysis, gathers up all of the divergent claims and demands of the people and the nation and shepherds them out into one, hopefully, more or less consistent forward movement which gives you, in the last analysis, a little net gain. If that works, then your legal system is accomplishing its task. You know, minimizes bloodshed, avoids as many disputes as possible, gives you the most effectively operating subsystems that you can expect in your society, moves society forward by changing its obsolete and its archaic patterns to meet the changed needs around it, and moves you forward, whatever forward may mean. Well, we still haven't answered the question, I suppose, of how do you do it, and what do you work with? Law has surprisingly few tools to try and do these things. I suppose there are only three things, when you come right down to it, that a court can do. They're not very complex things, either. A court can order somebody to do something, or order you not to do it. lower the lake so that they can fix their docks, or don't lower the lake so that the water will still be up high enough to unload boats. Order or not order? The law can change the status. I walked into the room a married man. I walked out single. So you call it divorce, it's a change of status. I had no father and mother when I came into the courtroom. And when I went out, I had a father and a mother. Called adoption. Change of status. It sets up whole new systems to which I belong. And incidentally, at another time, a little bit later, I'll suggest to you that therein lies the concept of what God does for us in His redemption and His grace. If I can ever dissuade you from thinking that sin is a violation of law, any law, it's a violation of a law is a misdemeanor or a felony. It doesn't happen to be sin. Sin happens to be alienation. And when one's status is changed from being alienated over to being in the family by adoption, then you have an effective operation of God's grace. But that's for another time. Law can order something, law can change a status, or law can simply declare a fact. It is your car, it is not your car. You are married, you are not married. Not changing anything, just announcing the fact. Now, it's this business of facts that you've got to watch very closely when you get into law. Now you've got just about all the machinery that there is. We've talked a little bit about the rules. And now we're going to talk a little bit about the facts. See, your rules are over here. They came to us either from the legislature or they came to us by a process which we in our system call the common law. That is a decision built, kind of public expectation. Maybe I should illustrate that before we go away from it. When I first married, after our honeymoon, when I got back to where I would have to go to work in the morning, I was, I believe, free either to walk out of the front door, yelling to my wife in the kitchen, "Goodbye, see you tonight," or I could choose an alternative form and walk out to the kitchen and kiss my wife goodbye and say, "I'll see you tonight." Had I not gone out to kiss my wife goodbye, I don't think I would have been in trouble. Now, as it happened, my wife was at the door instead of in the kitchen, and I kissed her goodbye. It was a pleasant experience. Apparently mutually so, because the next morning we met at the door again. On the first day, I think I could have gotten by that door without kissing my wife goodbye, without difficulty. But after kissing her goodbye for 20 or 30 days, had I gone through that door without kissing my wife goodbye, she would have sued. At least she would have said, "What's the matter? Don't you love me anymore?" She would have felt that her rights were violated. And what I want you to see is that, by Jiminy, she did have a right at this point, because there was an expectation built up. This is the way it operates, you see. Now, these rules are important to us because they do serve a couple functions. One is just exactly the one I've described, an expectation of what's going to happen. This is the way it's done. I can rely upon that. I can build the future upon that. I can make my plans that way. I can write my lease that way. I can make my payments on the house, anticipating that the law will protect my expectations when I get through. That's very important. Notice, incidentally, that the same rule also adjusts our difficulty when our problem is a novel one. And sometimes in doing this, distorts that very rule we've just been talking about in order to do justice in this case, rather than doing it the same old traditional way. And therefore, the law is once more forced both to preserve and to destroy tradition. And this always makes that interesting. So that's the process of the rule. Now the fact. Because, you see, in order to operate, you must have the rule made applicable to a set of facts. When you apply the rule to the facts, you come out with the conclusion. I'm sure you've all seen that operate many times. A jury, for example, is the finder of facts. The jury decides what the facts are by hearing the witnesses and by hearing the evidence. So when the jury has scooped up all of this evidence, it goes out and it finds what the facts are. And then the judge tells them what the law is. The court instructs about the law. And the jury applies the law to the facts and they come to the conclusion. It's just that simple. Where do you get these facts? Well, from the witnesses that I've been telling you about. Who are these witnesses? Well, the witnesses are the people who, for example, are contestants in a given case. Maybe a simple automobile case. One of them comes in and says the car was going recklessly down the street. This is the plaintiff, obviously. Being driven by the defendant who was acting like a madman, probably drunk, going 90 miles an hour. The defendant takes the stand and says, I was cold, stone, sober. I was driving cautiously and I wasn't going over 20. And there you've got 90 miles an hour against 20 miles an hour. When I first started practicing law, we had a judge in Seattle who was probably one of the best judges that we've had around here in a long, long time, except he happened to be, this is before we had a mandatory retirement law, and the judge happened to be a little bit over 90. Really, he was a glorious, fine chap, but he could hardly see anymore. And, he used to get way down in his leather chair like this. You'd swear he was asleep, you know. He wore a green visor to shade his eyes, and once in a while he'd haul out a big turnip watch and see if it was time for a recess yet, if he could get it in focus. You'd think he was asleep, and when he would get testimony of the sort that I've just told you about, this sharp conflict, if it happened to be, especially if it happened to be a day that he wasn't wearing his teeth, he'd get his finger in his mouth and start going around and around, and he'd say, this is the part I don't like. I don't like this part. Somebody's lying. That's not true. Because we perceive things very, very differently. I ran into the rear end of a car going over Snoqualmie Pass a few years ago. It's a very stupid thing to do, to tail end another car. You can't possibly win that suit. As I drove on home, looking at the bashed front end of my automobile, I thought about it and thought about it and thought about it. Reconsidered this, and by the time I got to my house, I was amazed at the nerve of that guy backing into me. All of these things come out, you see, in trial. You put your witnesses on the stand, and they tell you what they saw. They tell you what they heard. But you know as well as I do that what we hear and what we see screens through all of our feeling of I see things the way that I want to see them. I see them in my sense of perception. So somewhere out of this welder of conflicting evidence, somebody, the jury, if they're the jury is finding the facts, or the judge, if the judge is finding the facts, must decide what actually happened. And how do you do it? Well, you simply weigh it. Pretty soon you decide it. Well, you've got all the facts. You can decide it. Like fun, you can decide it. You never can decide it. Well, you never know. You can decide it. Now, if you'll stop and think a little while, I dare say it's very seldom that you've heard lawyers talk about knowing things. Lawyers give opinions. Lawyers decide. Lawyers and judges make judgments. But we don't pretend to know. We just decide. Carol likes to tease me because I once made the admission to him that we have a slogan in my business that says, although we are frequently in doubt, we're never in error. The other way around. Frequently in error, we're never in doubt. That's what I mean. Well, we are frequently in error, I suppose, but you can't be in doubt. You've got to decide. You've got to decide what kind of a question. That's what I want you to see right now, my friends. If a problem comes up that has an answer that can be solved in some way or other, it's never going to come into me, in my office. If you bought a ton of coal from somebody and he drives up and dumps a half a ton there, you can resolve that thing without my help. You can weigh it, see whether it's a ton or a half ton. Or if it's some other alleged deficiency in most of the transactions that we have in life, there's some way of measuring it or testing it or wrapping litmus paper around it or doing something that will indicate whether it's so or not so. If you took 100 cases that get out of the hands of people who argue to a lawyer, 97 of those 100 cases will never get out of the lawyer's office and never be an action filed, for the very simple reason that he will manage to screen out and say, well, this is the way it is, or that's the way it is, and it's clear enough, so you better resolve it here. Of that remaining 3% in which a complaint is filed, a few will get into trial, but most of them won't. They'll be settled before, a judgment of where the difference breaks. The question that gets to the trier of fact ultimately is a question that doesn't have an answer. It's there because it doesn't have an answer. It's there for a judgment. Judges are very uncomfortable, as juries are frequently uncomfortable, about deciding unanswerable questions. And we have a rule and a statute in the state of Washington that says that if a judge doesn't answer an issue within 6 months after it's been put to him, I mean, if he can't make up his mind, if he's still back there in the chambers throwing himself around, unable to resolve this thing, we stop his paycheck. You'd be surprised how many judges go without paychecks for a while. Every judge, before each paycheck, must solemnly swear that he has nothing that's overage on his desk. We force him, you see, to answer the insoluble issue ultimately. Even if it means just going back in the chamber and flipping a coin and coming back out in his black robe and announcing. Perfectly clear in this case. But I want you to see that too, my friends, because we in the church are masters of this sort of thing. Judges in their rhetoric are most positive about those things which are least certain. And when a judge says it is perfectly obvious that so-and-so, in fact so obvious that one need not even produce evidence, what he means is, I haven't the faintest idea, so I flip. The least certain we are, the less certain we are about things, the more dogmatic we tend to become in our statements, the less willing we are to examine them and to have our reasons assigned and scrutinized by the people around us. And if that fits theologically at times, why, let it fit where it fits. Watch Paul tomorrow. Now, in this process of resolving the facts, you've got to watch something else that happens here, and that is, that once the jury finds the fact, or the judge finds the fact, that is the fact. It's no matter what the facts really are. What is decided is the facts. The way it really is. We hire a guy to stand behind the batter or behind the catcher in a baseball game and squint out there when a pitcher pitches the ball. And when it comes this general direction, this guy's job is to announce that that was a strike or that was a ball. Now, we give him a rule that's supposed to be helpful in this connection. We tell him that if, in his judgment, the ball appears to have passed in an imaginary box which goes from the top of the shoulder to the bottom of the kneecap, I think it is, to the outside edges of the bag, that then he's supposed to say that was a strike. However, if you had scientific material set up so that you could really know where it went, and you can now scientifically demonstrate that the ball came down right through the middle of that, if the man back here announced that it was a ball, it was a ball. It isn't that he erroneously called a strike a ball, it was a ball, because he gets to name it. Now, I would not want a medical doctor to operate that way. For example, in the well-known Charlie Chaplin case, where they found Charlie was the father of the child down there in California, although their blood types were incompatible, this would be a bad way for a medical doctor to practice transfusions, to kill people. But they weren't practicing transfusions. They were answering a social problem. And sometimes the way you call them is influenced by where you want to go, what you're trying to accomplish, and you become somewhat goal-oriented in the process. Now, I suspect that by this point, I at least should be getting you to the place where maybe you can see that law is not simply an arbitrary application of a cut-and-dried rule to well-established facts and to come up with a data computer type answer out on the other end. Rather, it's a very, very dynamic and living process which involves people's concepts about what we ought to do, how it ought to be done, where we're going to go, why we want to do it. It's, nonetheless, is a system. It's a way, it's a method, it's a manner of resolving disputes. Resolving disputes with your eye on what is good. What are you trying to get? Ultimately, where are you trying to go? Don't forget that silly American proposition that we were talking about a little earlier. That somehow or other we do have the idea that mankind has inalienable rights, endowed by the Creator upon each of us, which the law tends to subserve and protect in some way. So you look for that thing that you might call the goal, the objective, the ultimate. Survey was done of the students who came in the University of Michigan School of Law a few years ago to see why they wanted to go to law school. Almost 84% of those poor rascals were in search of certainty. It sort of turns you inside out after you thought about it for a little while. They were looking for the ultimate, flat, firm, predictable, knowable authority in life. And obviously you don't get it. What you get is simply a system, a method, a way of doing things. So in this process of trying to resolve the disputes by getting out the best evidence that you can get about the facts, you devise means which are adversary means. One man says something, the other one says it isn't true. I contest the validity of what you said. You liar, you perjured yourself, or you're blind as a bat. The rules of evidence are rules which screen out things which can't come in because they are too speculative, or they are don't really apply to the case, or they're just what you heard somebody else say about something, so-called hearsay. The rules of procedure in law are designed primarily to protect people from doing things arbitrarily. The jury is there to serve as a check on the judge. The judge is there to serve as a check on the jury. The rules of procedure are essentially negative. The rules of evidence are essentially negative. In fact, all of law is really negative. It places limitations on what you can do. This is the last point I want to make with you tonight. I hope to use some of this tomorrow morning and Thursday when we talk about some other law-related problems. But I do want you to see right now that law is, in its very operation, essentially a negative thing. That is, it says to you, basically what we are trying to do is preserve, not create, but to preserve, to protect freedoms. I'm trying to go on the basic concept that we'll be better off if more of us are left as free as possible to be, to innovate and to be ingenious, subject each other to competitive pressures, put each other to the test to see what kind of new process, new material, or new understanding we can develop by challenging each other, to be free for this process. Compete and struggle brings out the best of us. The law's job is to see to it that this process, competitive process, the struggle process, the ingenious developing, necessity is the mother of invention kind of thing, is left as unhampered as it's possible to have it. That means that law essentially says you can't do that. You are free to swing your fist all right up to where the other guy's nose starts, but there you got to stop. The law says swing your fist any way that you like, be ingenious. Swing it inside out if you like. I don't care how you do it or where you do it or what time you do it, as long as you don't get over the line. Inside the line, you're perfectly free to innovate. The rule itself, the law itself, has a lot of that creativity, a lot of that innovative power in it. As Alice says, the words are just not, Alice in Wonderland, words are just not quite that clear, you see. No matter how precisely you try to state the rule, the principle that you're operating with, you still come out like Mary Henderley's quote from Soane, which is still ambiguous. I get so angry, for example, at people who go around saying they're in favor of motherhood when they don't even tell me whether they mean legitimate or illegitimate. People are so sloppy with their language. Well, rules are that way. You try and phrase it carefully, if you will, and yet inside there's lots of room. Lots of room for change and for coloration. My wife has decorated our front room, sort of a style that I like to think of as early American miscellaneous. And that room has a character to it. You might not like it. Maybe you would like it. If we moved out and you moved in, and if you didn't change any doors, any windows, if you didn't change the height of the ceiling or the walls or anything else, but you redecorated it in Scandinavian modern or something of that sort, it would be exactly the same room, or it would be a very different room. The outside limitations are precisely the same. The law, the rule, the wording is precisely the same, but the operation of that thing, what it does for people and how it operates, is quite different, if you see what I'm driving at. Of course, there is such a thing as skill and draftsmanship. When you lay down this prohibition not to do something, even the draftsman at times can be careless. When my eldest son was yet a baby walking around in diapers in the house, when I was still an unreformed sinner and smoked, he came out one night holding in his mouth my longest, blackest, filthiest pipe. My wife never really took to smoking, and she didn't like the sight of her diapered youngster coming out with a pipe in her mouth. So she gave me that sort of governor's message to the legislator look, which says, legislate, see? So I legislated. I said, Paul, put the pipe down on the ashtray. He, being a dutiful member of the country, went out to obey the law, walked over to the coffee table, knelt down, leaving the pipe in his mouth, and let it rest in the ashtray. There's a genius, you see. There's a genius to look at the rule and wonder how it can be shaped to mean something else. And so you must try and draw these lines as tightly as one can without choking, without destroying the room for ingenuity. And so you try and measure how far you can go without destroying. This concept is important to us because law is really not a creative thing, and I want you to see it. Law is not. Law is a negative thing. Law is always negative. There ain't no gospel in law. Not even in the Constitution. Constitution, the United States, is probably one of the most marvelous documents ever written. It works as well as if we didn't have one. England, you know, has gotten along pretty well without one. Maybe it's better. But you must not think that because something is constitutional, therefore it's good. This is not true. When something is constitutional, that means that you don't throw up when you look at it. It's tolerable. You can live with it. Something which is unconstitutional means it is so intolerable, so bad that you just can't live with it anymore. I got a good illustration of that this past week in a case that I lost without even getting down to the courtroom. The police raided one of our bookstores in Seattle recently, and they found one of the nicest pieces of salacious literature that I've ever seen in my life. It was beautiful. I was not involved in handling this case, but the prosecuting attorney, who was a former student of mine, deputy prosecuting attorney, King County, called me and said he'd like me to appear in this case as an expert witness. And I said, that's great, Paul. If you can qualify me as an expert in anything, I'll be down. What am I an expert in? And he said, in obscene literature. And I said, why me, you know? So like Bill Cosby's response, why me? And he says, well, because I've called about 15 people around town, none of them want to get involved, and I need a witness. I've got a couple other guys. I got one rabbi and one Lutheran pastor, and now I want you to be an expert witness. I never got a chance to testify in this case because one of the other two expert witnesses took the stand and testified that he thought the material was obscene, all right. And on cross-examination, they asked him, if you took this one poem out of the magazine and read it someplace else, would you think that it might be interpreted this way and that that might have some literary value? Well, the poor guy was a clergyman, see? He was caught. He had to be honest. What could he do? He wasn't ingenious enough to know that the answer to the question was yes, but it's not out of that, not out of the context. And he simply answered the question, yes, I would say that it had some merit.
which point the judge says that's true. It's all. First Amendment protects anything which has any value at all. In order to be obscene, it must be totally devoid of worth and value. Here you're caught in one of those very interesting sort of combinations. You see, it isn't unconstitutional unless it's so intolerable that you vomit when you see it. Constitutional means that you can tolerate it. It does not mean that it's good. And on this kind of a happy note, I'd like to end for this evening. If I've gotten you now to see that because something is lawful, because something is constitutional, does not mean that it's good. It simply means that it's something we can live with. Law is a way of lessening man's barbarity to man. It's a way of resolving disputes by minimizing bloodshed. It's a way of regularizing our grasping instincts so that I get my fair share and you get your fair share. There is not, however, in this package of law, any grace, any love, any real concern. Justice is a very unpleasant thing compared to grace. But justice is an other way of life. It's not a very good way of life, but it's a way in which people can relate to each other if these people cannot relate to each other in a better way. There are at least two ways of life that you can think about. Justice is sort of the original poverty program. Well, that's enough for that. It'll get me where I want to go. If any of you want to cross-examine, shoot. Yes, ma'am.
I'm interested in the idea of rights. When you said this about this certain inalienable rights, you know, the foolish and really, what does that mean? You weren't speaking then about the Bill of Rights, which gets very specific and so forth. I'm thinking, and it's because you went on to say that rights are a matter of what is expected. You know, you kiss your wife, a certain number of times, you're right. I'm thinking of the civil rights movement and how, certainly for Negroes in the South, many of the things which people who have worked in the movement would say are rights, according to that definition, are not rights at all. There certainly was no reason for them to expect a drink at a lunch counter or even a fair trial, you know, or anything like that. I mean, there was no history of that. So I wondered how you differentiated there between...
A right, I think, in law is something that you can get enforced. If you can't get enforced, you don't have a right. A mother who says, the child is crying and you should do something because I've got a right to get a good night's sleep, is just wrong. You can't go down to the judge and get it enforced.
Yeah, well then what if people, again, in civil rights movement, are trying to get certain things enforced for a long time and that they still fail? You know? Now, do you feel that it's foolish? Or unrealistic, or whatever you want to call it, to go on trying to get something enforced that is not enforced, you know?
No. I think that one sets goals for oneself by looking at something else outside of the legal method itself.
Yeah.
If we had enough time here to do a good job of it, I'd like to talk at this point about what ultimately is authority. What ultimately is good, true, and beautiful.
Yeah, I want to ask if you believe in justice with a big J.
No, I don't.
I don't want to ask that now.
No, I don't. It depends how big you make the J.
Yeah.
I think that justice is a lot better than injustice.
Yeah.
I think people having something to eat is a lot better than people not having something to eat. But these things are all relatives, not absolutes. This is the way I feel about justice. I do think there is such a thing as an authority for a man's life. I find it, however, not in legal patterns. Authority to a lawyer means what some court said last year, and maybe if I can dress it up enough, I can con this judge into thinking it's still the governing principle. This is what we, you know, sort of use that word authority, but surely that's not what authority means ultimately. It means more than that. So, I think that when one uses the word rights quite technically, that you must have in mind some enforcement, some way of implementing it.
Or else you have to speak of it in terms of this is a goal.
Or else you are using the word right in a way which doesn't fit the scheme that I'm talking about this evening. If one can use the word to mean what you want it to mean.
Yeah, right.
And
no,
that's,
I went on one of
those. Fair enough.
Where I tease him is where you'll have a chance, I hope, to hear him some more. He uses this phrase very well, often in error, but never in doubt. And I tell him that it's just the opposite of the professor, who is never in error, but always in doubt. And I think that the Bar Association of England has a point in wanting to sue the translators of the New English Bible, but they're up against their own law. I suppose the professors had the last word. They translated it. They tell it to them the other way around.
This is the thing that made the Reformation, actually, Carol, this concept. Fortunately, you see, Luther had legal training. Had it not been for that, we'd still be in trouble, I suppose. Luther did see, ultimately, the concept of being beaten back and back and back, and trying, as long as Luther was wound up in this process of having to cover every misdeed, every violation of law, every sin, if you want to use it in that horrible sense, as long as he had a plaster over every one of those black marks with a green stamp that he got for doing something good, and he was constantly losing, and the black marks were piling up faster than he could get the green stamps over here. Now, what to do about this is to immobilize yourself, withdraw, and minimize your contacts and your opportunities to hurt somebody. And so Luther really withdrew. The monastic life, down into the cell, you know, finally trying to avoid any contact with human beings. Then he finally realized that although he was frequently in error, that he couldn't possibly afford to go through life constantly doubting. Thy grace is sufficient for me. The concept of being willing to, I hate to say sin, concept of being willing to be in error in what you do, to make mistakes, quite confident that God's grace is sufficient to overcome this, is the thing that frees Luther. And you've got to be willing to do this when you're dealing with other people, when you're dealing with other men, because you make mistakes. You kill people. You let people starve. You've got to make decisions. You're forced into this. And all you can say is that God's grace makes it possible for me to go out and kill. God's grace makes it possible for me to go out and injure somebody. Because make no mistake, you do. Whenever you divide the spoils, you give some to somebody and some to somebody else. You give and you take simultaneously. Life is constantly a process of doing justice and making decisions, helping here and hurting there, benefiting one and impoverishing another. Now, in this kind of process, you are constantly involved in the very real possibility, in fact, in the experience of making errors. And the Reformation is a process which makes this possible for us to live, knowing that we are in error much of the time that we act. But then that's another story for another time.
You know, I never told you something, it might be fun for you to know. Oscar had always used to boast that he had never ordained a pastor without telling him, go out and make mistakes. Then we know you're alive.
All the pastors that I've known must have heard that. that's not a good place to quit. Let me quit with one that maybe is a little bit more appropriate. A little while ago, we were putting a new ceramic business in our bath at home. And I tried. It didn't do very well. The fact is, it wasn't tolerable. It was unconstitutional. I finally had to get a friend of mine who is a craftsman in this business. He is a man who puts down ceramic tile. He came to the house to get me out of my mess. And, of course, he knew my business as I knew his. And as he was standing there putting them up on the wall like that, he looked to me and he says, well, lawyer, you can't lie to a piece of ceramic tile. I thought it was pretty good. Had enough?
No.
Quit. Tomorrow morning, after Paul has confused you, I will take another whack at him.
Paul gets his word in tomorrow, and he'll get it. He should be able to get both hours off. You can hear both men. back in the days when we didn't have so many pressing things to do around here, we sort of all took off to listen. In fact, you wouldn't have missed it. I think we still are.
But you're bound to have a case of indigestion with what you've... I'm going on the assumption now that you may have listened to something that I was saying tonight. If you did, it's bound to get to you after a while. If you think about it for a little while, and I'm going to be quite serious about this, we have, I think, all grown up in the concept that law really is to be observed. I think one of the times that I first got into serious trouble with my brother, who is a pastor, was when I suggested to him that maybe the time had come to redo the Ten Commandments. Now, you see, this is kind of touchy ground. His catechism and mine starts out with an awful lot on law. And somehow or other it seems to many people that the law is there to be observed, that man is there to serve the law. And I'm suggesting to you just as flatly as I can that is not true. The law is a tool created by God just the way that he created a pick and shovel to be used by you to accomplish God's will. And God's will is not that you should observe his commandments. I'm not coming out strong against them, you understand. I'm saying that the end of the game is not the observance of the law. That way lies death. If you can't do any better than be constitutional, believe me, friends, we've had it. In constitution, there is bankruptcy. You've got to go ahead and be able to be creative above that. You've got to be able to exceed the measure of what the law demands. If all that you can do is what you're driven into, at the risk of being thrown into jail, we have had it. There's no other body that I know of that ought to be able to see that quite as quickly as you. Because if the church cannot grasp the difference between love and concern for human beings, which exceeds anything which the law has to offer, I don't know where we'd find it. This is a concept which we must be able to give. Well, that's enough. More.